in a killing field. And then I'm watching columnists and I'm watching reporters on this side of the planet essentially pretend that those folks don't exist. Because, hey, it's controversial and who knows, and maybe they're linked to Hamas and whatever. And I can't use the word journalism to describe all of that. I need a different word. Because right now, while I'm watching such fundamental failures of journalism, I'm also watching some of the best examples of journalism in the world. And again, we go back to this idea of the disconnect, the dissociation, the chasm between two things. And for me, that's what it comes down to, is what does that word mean? Because it's describing two very different things right now.
And we're going to talk more about that in part two of our discussion, and we're going to post it online at democracynow.org. Omar El-Aked is a journalist and award-winning author. His new book is just out. It's called One Day, Everyone Will Have Always Been Against This. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.
Well, hello. What's this? Would you look at that? It's KBOO's special Earth Day Marathon coming up on Tuesday, April 22nd. Looks like it'll feature local environmental advocates, native perspectives, Earth-conscious music, radio shows on Espanol, and plenty of nature sounds. A full day's worth, it looks like. KBOO's Earth Day programming kicks off on Monday, April 21st at 10 p.m. and runs through 10 p.m. Tuesday. All the information is online at kboo.fm/earthday. That's kboo.fm/earthday. Leave it better than you found it.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council kicks its ban on algorithmic rental price fixing back to committee. Portlanders rally against a PGE plan to cut down 400 trees in Forest Park, and an Oregon State University student sues the federal government for pulling their visa. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 17th, 2025. I'm Althea Billings. Portland City Council won't be voting on its proposed ordinance to ban artificial intelligence algorithm price fixing in the rental market in the near future. This comes after the proposal made it out of committee and was heard twice by the council. So many Portlanders wanted to testify at these various meetings that registration had to be closed early, and each person had only 2 minutes to share their thoughts. The ordinance would ban landlords and property managers from using AI algorithms to artificially inflate or fix the rent market. 47% of Portlanders are renters, and the city has both a housing and a homelessness crisis. The two are inextricably linked there. There aren't enough homes and apartments for people who live here, at least not enough that they can afford. Software programs like RealPage are often used by big-time property owners, ones who own at least 30 units, and they're the center of this potential ban. That also means that the proposed ban shouldn't impact small landlords. At City Council's meeting last night, dozens of Portlanders came out to testify.
My name is Leah Belton. I support the ban on algorithmic rent pricing. I'm here for myself, my fellow renters, and East County Rising, which serves District 1 and East Multnomah County. We are deeply concerned about the housing and eviction crisis. A 2018 City of Portland assessment on gentrification and displacement highlighted East Portland's unique vulnerability. East Portland has had the most rapid increase in housing costs citywide since 2008, the year I graduated from Reynolds High. Over 14,000 low-income, cost-burdened renter households live in East Portland, and they're being pushed out in Park Rose and Rosewood. Black and brown Portlanders are being displaced the fastest. Institutional racism and historical redlining laid the foundation. And today, the use of algorithmic price-fixing tools continues this displacement. You have the power to slow this displacement. Please do not give in to misinformation and scare tactics. Help us pay reasonable rents instead. Vote yes on this ordinance. Do not water it down. Banning price-fixing algorithms to close a collusion loophole will not tank the housing market. Algorithmic price-fixing tools enable our capital to be mined out of our community with ease. Help us keep our money in our local economy. East County Rising and I urge you all to vote yes on this ordinance and protect the people who actually live in this city.
My name is Lorena Gayette. I am speaking in favor of this ordinance. I did have previous testimony, but I decided to scrap it in order to rebuttal some of the misinformation that was presented at the previous council meeting. First, in response to the claim that the software is not price fixing, or like RealPage. It was reported in 2022 that RealPage executives have been quoted as taking credit for a 14% increase in rent and referring to landlords who refuse to increase rent as idiots. Employees state landlords who want to charge reasonable rates have an empathy problem and have admitted to disincentivizing landlords from doing so, even kicking some landlords off of the software. As a Latina, I took offense to the idea that this ordinance would prevent generational wealth from developing in Black and brown communities when demographics for this city show that more than 60% of Black and Hispanic are renters in Portland, meaning that the biggest hurdle for our communities is being rent burdened and first-time home buying. What percentage of them do you think are landlords? We need to ensure that all of our community is protected, not just those who are able to invest in property. And you are being presented with a false dichotomy that we must either focus on building homes or regulating costs. It is important to state that not only can we do both, but we must do both. Under normal conditions, more housing will bring prices down, but RealPage and software like it are built for the purpose of disrupting these types of market forces. All the housing in the world means nothing if we allow software to run rampant and remove any incentive to lower prices. This ordinance is a necessary preventative measure that needs to be applied yesterday.
That was an excerpt of some testimony at Wednesday's City Council meeting about a proposed ordinance to ban AI price fixing in the rental market. Despite significant public support, the ordinance's chief sponsor, Councilor Angelita Murillo, motioned to move the ordinance back to committee. She referenced litigation going on in Berkeley, California, where a similar ordinance was challenged in a federal lawsuit by the company RealPage. In their lawsuit, the company said Berkeley's attempt to ban AI price fixing violated the company's free speech. Here's Councilor Murillo.
I just want to start off by thanking everyone so much who has come multiple times to City Hall to testify. It means a lot to us how engaged you are in the process, that you've come to committee, that you've come to full council. And it's just immense how much you guys care about your community and what's going on in it. And I'm extremely grateful for that. I also wanted to say that Just this past week, an article came out that said that in the 5 hours since opening the waitlist on Tuesday, Home Forward received nearly 7,000 applications. And our 2024 Portland Insight survey just came out, and it showed that 72.4% of Portlanders told us that affordable housing was their top issue. It's kind of with a heavy heart that I have to say this, that there's some new litigation elsewhere that touches on similar issues with the algorithmic price fixing ordinance. And I want to assert that the litigation is not determinative of what's going to happen here, but it's worth us keeping an eye on and being responsible stewards of policy and maintaining good conversations with stakeholders as we look into it. So while the council is facing other immediate priorities like the upcoming budget, it makes sense to me to keep this item in the committee for further discussion. So with that, I move to refer item 9 back to the Homelessness and Housing Committee.
Second.
That was Councillor Murillo moving to kick the ban on algorithmic price fixing back to committee. That motion passed unanimously, with other councillors expressing their hope that they would get to see the measure back at full council for a vote soon. Portlanders rallied outside of City Hall today in opposition to a decision made by the hearings officer to allow Portland General Electric to move forward with a plan to cut down at least 400 trees in Forest Park. KBOO's Lexis Ponce has the details.
Defend Forest Park! Defend Forest Park! Defend Forest Park!
Hi, I'm Brenna Bell with 350 PDX. I'm the Forest Climate Manager.
And what brings you out here today?
Well, I love Forest Park. Like everyone in Portland, pretty much, we are concerned that PGE is planning to put a clear cut for power lines through Forest Park. They have other alternate routes that don't cut down trees in a public park, and we're really encouraging them to take those alternatives.
What action would you like to see the city councilors take?
Well, the city councilors are evaluating an appeal that was brought by the Forest Park Conservancy and the Forest Park neighborhood, appealing the hearings officer's decision that PGE's plans comply with the Forest Park Management Plan. And so we're hoping that the city of Portland, the new city councilors in their judicial role, find that it does not comply with that plan and go with what their own staff said and not give PGE the go-ahead to move forward on this project.
And why is this so important, and what do you most want people to know about this issue?
I think there's so much attention on this because it involves Forest Park, but it's really important because it's just indicative of a much bigger problem, whereas the drive to gain corporate profit is seen as more important than anything else. It's seen more important than the trees, seen more important than the public's engagement with the forest. It's seen more important than the climate resilience that the forest gives us. And this is really just about PGE making more money by doing something that's easier for them. And so it's a micro issue that illustrates a much, much larger problem. And City Council has the ability to do the right thing today and choose the public benefit over that corporate profit.
And that's all I have for you today.
Okay.
Thank you for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Defend Forest Park! Defend Forest Park! Defend Forest Park! Defend Forest Park!
For KBOO News, I'm Lexis Ponce.
Oregon schools for higher education do not seem to be immune to action by immigration and customs enforcement. Now, an Oregon State University student is bringing forward a lawsuit after ICE abruptly terminated his legal status. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more.
An international student at Oregon State University filed a lawsuit against the Trump administration after it revoked his legal status. Aaron Ortega Gonzalez is a Mexican citizen and a PhD student at Oregon State. He has been researching the impact of wildfires on ranchlands. According to the lawsuit filed in the U.S. District Court of Oregon yesterday, officials with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, went into a government-controlled database of student visas in early April and terminated Ortega Gonzalez's status. Ortega Gonzalez has reportedly been given no reason for the federal government's action. Three legal teams are representing him: the ACLU of Oregon, the legal nonprofit Innovation Law Lab, and the immigration law firm of Nelson Smith, LLP. Their filing said immigration officials wrote in the database, quote, individual identified in criminal records check, and or has had their visa revoked, end quote. Oregon State University's Offices of International Services reportedly emailed Ortega Gonzalez on April 8th, alerting him to the change. He has not been detained, but was told he is expected to depart the United States immediately. The lawsuit asked the court to reinstate his status. Ortega Gonzalez was born and raised in Mexico, where he obtained his undergraduate degree. He applied for and received a student visa in 2021. He received a master's degree in Texas before moving to Corvallis to pursue his doctorate. Attorneys for Ortega Gonzalez say he has never committed a crime or even a traffic violation. He has never withdrawn from his studies, which could result in visa termination, nor has he broken other rules such as engaging in unauthorized employment. His attorney said, quote, not only was Aaron unilaterally stripped of his status and denied due process rights as it violates the law, the critical research he was working on has been halted, end quote. The move comes as the federal government continues to target international students across the United States by revoking their visas. That includes 4 students at the University of Oregon and 2 students at Portland State University. Many of the federal government's moves have allegedly been aimed at ending anti-Semitism. Homeland Security officials recently announced the agency has begun monitoring social media activity of people seeking lawful permanent resident status, as well as international students for posts that, quote, support anti-Semitic terrorism, end quote. Neither OSU officials nor ICE responded to requests for comment. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. Then we'll speak with activist Tracy Molina about the conditions inside the Multnomah County Detention Center. Stick around at 6, it's Rose City Native Radio, then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with an overnight low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 73 degrees. Today in history, in 1986, a peace is declared in an alleged state of war lasting 335 years between the Netherlands and the Isles of Scilly off the coast of England. The truce ended any hypothetical war that may have been legally considered to exist. The quote of the day is from Colombian journalist and Nobel laureate Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who died this day in 2014. He wrote, quote, a lie is more comfortable than doubt, more useful than love, more lasting than truth. Some 1,400 military and overseas ballots could be tossed in the uncertified North Carolina Supreme Court race. The State Department closes its office monitoring foreign disinformation, and GOP-led states move to end mail-in voting grace periods. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Those who raise their hand and get first in line to serve our country should not now be first in line to have their votes tossed.
North Carolina Supreme Court Justice Allison Riggs says she'll fight as long as it takes to ensure every vote cast in the November state Supreme Court race is counted. Despite beating her Republican challenger by more than 700 votes, a state court has ruled some 1,400 military and overseas ballots will be discarded unless those voters provide a copy of their photo ID within 30 days. Some military spouses have sued to block the verification process. Democratic lawmakers are in El Salvador pushing the release of Maryland resident Kilmar Abrego Garcia, who the White House says was deported and sent to a maximum security prison due to an administrative error. The Supreme Court has ordered the Trump administration to facilitate his release, but officials say their hands are tied. Garcia's wife, Jennifer, says she remains hopeful.
Kilmar, if you can hear me, stay strong. God hasn't forgotten about you.
Meanwhile, a federal judge says he's found probable cause to hold the Trump administration in criminal contempt of court for violating orders to temporarily halt deportation flights. The State Department's main office for fighting foreign disinformation will close. Republicans have accused it of coordinating with social media companies to stifle conservative opinions worldwide. Michigan Congressman Bill Huizenga says American voices were also silenced in the process.
Freedom of speech is a God-given right enshrined in the First Amendment of our nation's Constitution. It is a right that President Trump and his administration are committed to zealously protecting.
The Trump administration has fired or reassigned dozens of officials who monitor U.S. elections for foreign interference and protect against cyber attacks. GOP-led states are complying with President Donald Trump's recent executive order prohibiting the counting of mail-in ballots that arrive after Election Day. At least 18 states and the District of Columbia allow grace periods, often due to slow postal service. Utah Governor Spencer Cox says the public wants to know the winner on election night.
Anything we can do to help people have more faith, restore their faith in Utah's elections, we should be doing that while still balancing that we should make it as easy as possible to vote.
Republicans argue without evidence that mail-in ballots are a source of voter fraud. The New Hampshire Senate has passed a bill requiring people who vote by mail to provide proof of citizenship with their ballots. The bill also applies to voter registration by mail. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Native food banks are having to adjust to the major cuts made by the Trump administration to the USDA, which helps support anti-hunger efforts. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Food banks are trying to adjust after the U.S. Department of Agriculture cut $500 million from a nationwide emergency food assistance program. One of those impacted organizations meets the pressing need for food access within the Crow and Northern Cheyenne tribes of southeastern Montana. Yellowstone Public Radio's Kayla DeRoche reports from Crow Agency on a recent day in April.
Andrea, get the table.
It's late Tuesday morning in a gas station parking lot off Interstate 90, and Centerpol founder Peggy Wellknown Buffalo directs the setup of a table, soon to be stacked with boxes of canned salmon, loose potatoes, and meat. Cars are already lining up to pick up food.
We try to be in a location where it's easier for them to come from the housing projects and from around town.
With only a few small grocery stores and gas stations located across this large swath of southeast Montana, the Crow and Northern Cheyenne reservations are considered food deserts. The grassroots nonprofit, Centerpol, tries to fill that gap with help from the Montana Food Bank Network, and Well-Known Buffalo says the need is high.
Sometimes we stay until 3, but today a lot of people have been calling.
Well-Known Buffalo talks about her concerns going forward. Montana Food Bank Network recently learned about cuts slated for more than 70 food banks across the state, Centerpol included. Montana Food Bank Network distributes food through the Emergency Food Assistance Program, or TFAP, a U.S. Department of Agriculture program that directs food to low-income areas. Montana Food Bank Network program manager Jesse Schroffnagel says they had committed to delivering food through the end of the year when they learned that one of TFAP's primary funding streams had been eliminated.
And as of the beginning of this month, all of those truckloads have been canceled. So what that amounts to is roughly 40% of our total TFAP allocation that we're anticipating not receiving for the remainder of the year.
According to records through the Montana Food Bank Network, the cuts account for more than a quarter of the total food Centerpol estimates it distributes in a year. Well-Known Buffalo says Centerpol plans to navigate the cuts to their pantry by establishing public gardens to grow food and indigenous plants they source from the hills in the region.
We're going to get hit with the craziness of what our government is doing. But the ones that are going to suffer is my people, us, Native.
Reporting from Crow Agency, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Native American California Assemblymember James Ramos, chair of the Native American Caucus, is insisting on a hearing to address the state auditor's newest findings dealing with the University of California system in returning Native American remains and cultural items to tribes. A third report from the state auditor was issued this week. Ramos says the audit shows UC lacks accountability and urgency in returning remains and cultural items required by the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA, and its state counterpart, CalNAGPRA. According to the report, UC continues to hold the human remains of thousands of individuals and hundreds of thousands of potential cultural items. Ramos says it's very disturbing to him as a Serrano Cahuilla person who still conducts reburials of his people that a law implemented 35 years ago is still being discussed today. The report finds the university has not ensured the proper care and security of potential cultural items and says at the current pace, it will likely take more than a decade to repatriate all of the collections. Ramos says the ancestors of tribal Californians deserve to be interred respectfully and in the traditions of their people. And he says lawmakers need to assess and or create penalties for noncompliance with the laws. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Black Maternal Health Week wraps up its 8th annual observance today with more than 300 organization partners inside and outside the country. Black women in the U.S. are more than 2 times more likely to experience adverse complications during or after childbirth. The week-long campaign serves to highlight Black maternal health disparities while cultivating community-based solutions. Judith Ruiz Branch has more from Wisconsin.
Today marks the last day of Black Maternal Health Week, a nationally and internationally recognized observance that serves to build community collaboration around addressing the maternal health statistics for Black women. Black women in the U.S. are more than 3 times more likely to die of a pregnancy-related cause than white women and are more than 2 times more likely to experience complications that negatively impact their health. The majority of them are preventable. The week-long campaign that serves to highlight these disparities was founded in 2018 by the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. Executive Director Angela Ina says while there have been great strides since the launch, more attention needs to be paid to the root causes of maternal morbidity and mortality.
It really does point to how pervasive and how systemic and structural gendered racism and obstetric violence is very, very much in our systems.
The rate of adverse outcomes for Black women in Wisconsin have increased significantly in the past decade, with Black women across the state more than 1.5 times more likely to experience them and more than 2 times more likely to experience a pregnancy-related death. In 2023, the overall maternity mortality rate in the U.S. decreased, while rates for Black women slightly increased. The outcomes also impact infant health, with those born to Black, American Indian, and Alaska Native, and Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander women experiencing an increased mortality rate than those born to white people. Ina says while Black Maternal Health Week amplifies the lived experiences of Black women, it does not exclude others.
We are wanting to see a change for those most impacted, those most vulnerable, those most at risk of these issues and these challenges, and that when we address it, it has a ripple and domino effect for everybody else.
Ina says structural issues such as housing, economics, and maternity care deserts all play a role. She emphasized the need to increase midwife care, the number of birth centers, and funding to community-based organizations to positively impact Black maternal health outcomes.
To really understand and value the lives of Black people and the lives of Black women in particular, the lives of us all, and the fact that we are all deserving of quality, comprehensive maternal and reproductive health care.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
The Nonviolent Peace Force is a global civilian protection organization that supports peace. It's one of the groups facing major funding challenges after the Trump administration abruptly canceled nearly 90% of the USAID programs in January. Tramell Gomes reports from Florida.
As global conflicts and natural disasters escalate, groups like the Nonviolent Peace Force, which works to protect civilians in conflict zones, faces severe funding challenges. The Trump administration's cancellation of nearly 90% of funding for USAID programs has sent shockwaves through the humanitarian sector. The funding cuts also reverberate in the Sunshine State, home to over 120 registered international relief organizations, among the highest concentrations in the country, including Miami-based World Relief and Coconut Creek's Food for the Poor. Nonviolent Peace Force says its Myanmar program is among the casualties. The group's Megan Rogers says the timing couldn't be worse as Myanmar grapples with the aftermath of devastating earthquakes. Rogers underscores the dire consequences of these cuts.
The stop work order from the Trump administration in January, followed by cancellation of nearly 90% of all USAID programs, has definitely hit the sector really significantly at a time when humanitarian needs have really never been higher. The funding available for those needs is really significantly contracting.
Despite partial 2025 funding restored after January's initial cuts, Nonviolent Peace Force says critical gaps remain. From wars in Gaza, Sudan, and Ukraine to climate-driven disasters displacing millions, Rogers says they are now racing to protect 2026 budgets through the House Subcommittee Overseeing Foreign Aid, chaired by Florida Republican Mario Diaz-Balart. Rogers warns merging USAID with the State Department, as proposed in a Trump administration memo, could slow critical aid responses. But she points to hope in South Sudan, where she says women from rival communities now work together to protect children from violence.
So that's an example of community organizing that has actually protected a lot of children from abduction, from violence, because women are stepping up and saying that they don't want to be a part of this violence and they want to protect themselves from it. So stepping away from that cyclical process of violence.
As congressional budget negotiations unfold, peacekeeping groups stress that the stakes extend far beyond politics and that millions of lives hang in the balance. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 17th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, Lexis Ponce, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Catherine Carley, Antonia Gonzalez, Judith Ruiz Branch, Mark Moran, Tramell Gomes, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of